Welcome to Under the Sun on 91.3 WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch. Under the Sun is a program that tells the stories of South Florida, people talking about their lives and the place where we live.
These are some of the voices you'll hear over the next hour.
Where am I going to find green pantyhose? Opaque green pantyhose.
Number two is be so horrendous that he wants to let you in for comedic value.
Thank you. Oh my goodness, I haven't had keys in months.
People retire to Florida all the time. Why can't the cats retire to Florida?
Palm trees, palm trees. He was seduced on the spot and never got over it.
We'll hear about a program that places homeless families in foreclosed homes.
A couple that makes art from cast-off clothing.
And what it takes to get past the velvet rope.
In today's show, we're looking at South Florida as the end of the line. This is where US 1 reaches mile marker zero, where the continental US runs into the sea, and where so many come to retire.
Miami Beach was the end of the line for serial killer Andrew Cunanan. His cross-country murder spree ended after he killed Johnny Versace and then himself here in 1997. But 5 years earlier, another serial killer, this one from Austria, led police on an international manhunt that ended right here in South Beach. His name was Jack Unterweger. Author John Leake wrote about Unterweger in his book, Entering Hades.
Through some of his connections in the underworld in Vienna, he had heard of Miami as a place where you could go as a criminal. And there were a lot of illicit jobs that could be found. I mean, I think he brought his 18-year-old girlfriend along with him, knowing that he could put her to work as a stripper, which he did the day after they arrived. It's like he immediately knew what he could do in Miami to pay the bills.
Unterweger, it turns out, was drawn here because he loved Miami Vice.
Imagine a warrant were issued for your arrest for murdering seven women, and you've got to figure out where to go to. And you choose Miami because you're a Don Johnson Miami Vice fan. There's something crazy about that, but it demonstrates the power of fantasy over a guy like Jack Unterweger.
Leake says it's the power of fantasy that links serial killers to South Beach.
Cunanan, I think one commonality he had with Jack Unterweger, the bad guy in my book, was this narcissism. I mean, let's face it, South Beach is a very narcissistic place. I mean, it's all about the way you look, the car you drive. Interestingly enough, Jack Unterweger visited, I know this because I've read his diary, he visited the Police Hall of Fame and then came across the causeway and was walking back to the beach when he saw a 1967 Candy Apple Red Mustang Fastback. And he just thought, wow, that is the perfect car for cruising South Beach, and showed it to his girlfriend. And she said, forget it, we're not buying that old car. And I just thought that was kind of a funny little vignette because it showed how, despite the fix he was in, he still really wanted to get into the scene here.
Unterweger was caught trying to pick up a wire transfer at a USA money exchange on Collins and 11th. The federal marshal who caught him was a former tackle at the University of Miami. It's Under the Sun on 91.3 WLRN. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman. Next up, we look at how people in South Florida make a living. It's our regular segment called All in a Day's Work. There are gavel clubs around the world. Most of them teach public speaking to business people. Today, we're introducing you to a public speaking coach who volunteers at a gavel club inside a prison on the western edge of Miami-Dade County.
My name is Chris Wolf, president of the Voices of Time Gavel Club at Everglades Correctional Institution. The purpose of the Voices of Time Gavel Club is to improve lives by teaching people to speak, listen, and think. The vast majority of the men in the Voices of Time Gavel Club have been convicted of either first-degree murder, second-degree murder, or armed robbery. However, because they committed their sentences prior to 1984, they've now served their mandatory 25 years and they're eligible for parole consideration. And whatever we can do to help them transition successfully, the better for everybody. Today is actually a very special day because not only are the Gators, my Gators, playing for the national championship tonight.
It's
It's also my 50th birthday. After the prepared speech portion of the meeting, then we go into the impromptu speech portion of the meeting. That's when the Table Topics Masters will, with no notice, call on one of the members of the audience. That member has to stand on their feet and speak for at least 60 seconds.
I have a lot to prove to the commission, to my family, to the community as a whole. Most so my wife, my children, my grandchildren, because each time we come through that door, we hurt everyone who cares anything about us.
At each Gavel Club meeting, everybody has a job to do. We have a timer and a joke master to make sure people speak within their time frame. And what the timer has to do at the end of the meeting is tell a joke, a clean joke.
You know, I remember one time when we were coming to the United States, my mom says, "We're going to the United States, Alex." And I says, "For real?" But on the way here, halfway here, I says, "Mom, I want to go back." And she says, "Shut up and keep swimming." You know, so. And I've been in here a long time myself, 28 years. So I also fear the change that we're going to be faced with out in society. But we have here a chance to prepare ourselves.
The changes in the men have been absolutely incredible. When we started that club, we could barely get the men to speak for more than 30 seconds. And a lot of them would stare at the top of their shoes while they spoke. And now we joke that we can't shut them up.
Where does community start? It starts right in here. It don't start when you get out. You got to learn about community right here. You got to believe in it.
Once within these walls, you are treated as though you are an inanimate object a lot of times, simply a number. And then we come to an environment like this, and we are touched wonderfully. If I may repeat Chris's mantra, no one is all good or all bad.
Nobody is all good or all bad. My father did very bad things. But he was a good father to me when I was young, and I still remember him as a good father. And these men seem to identify with that. Sometimes people say to me, "Well, why are you helping prisoners and not children?" These guys have nobody. And this is something that I'm good at.
For anybody to come out here and spend time with us, it's an indication of love. It's penetrated my heart.
I always joke with people that you'll never speak to a more appreciative crowd than a bunch of men in prison. We get standing ovations constantly. Over the years, there's been about 170 inmates who have been paroled and passed through the system. Of all of those inmates, only one was returned for an actual crime. And as I look down our roster, I look at, you know, Isaac, paroled. Here's another one, paroled, deceased, paroled, 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 paroled. Deceased, paroled, paroled.
We're knocking at the door. No, we're not the people we once were. Nor will we be once more.
It doesn't matter if I'm having a good day or a bad day. On Thursday at 5:30, I'm in that classroom because I know they're there waiting for me.
Was produced by Under the Sun's Trina Sargalski. Those are the guys in the Gavel Club singing about going home, about getting out of prison.
Wasn't your mom a teacher in prison as well?
Yeah, she spent 8 years teaching English as a second language in a federal prison. And I have to tell you, you know, she also taught high school French and Spanish for many years. And she said that her prison teaching experiences were some of the best of her whole teaching career. She would come home with the most amazing stories. On Valentine's Day, they decorated her classroom with hearts and flowers. And for her birthday, they would give her the most ornate, beautiful, hand-done birthday cards. And that was like the best part of their day. That's the thing. The classroom for them was the best part of their day.
Oh, my God. I've done some teaching, and I think about the nasty looks that are the gift that I get when I'm in class. I think I need to, you know, work on a different population of my
right.
teaching.
You can find us on the web at WLRNunderthesun.org.
Take Back the Land is a group that fights to feed and house people in Miami's historically black communities. In October 2006, the group took over a vacant lot in Liberty City and created a thriving shanty town called Umoja Village. The shanty town burned down 6 months later. The group's latest project is to place homeless families into vacant foreclosed houses. Max Rameau, co-founder of Take Back the Land, calls them home liberations. They've done 8 so far. I joined Max on a recent move-in. We drive down a tree-lined street of single-family homes in Little Haiti. Is this it? Is this the house?
It's the house.
Could you describe it for me?
It is a single-story house. It has a slanted roof. Looks like it was painted relatively recently, so it's in very, very good condition on the outside.
We're with Marie Nadine Pierre, a mother of 4. This morning, Nadine was living in a shelter. Now she's about to move into a 4-bedroom house. She clutches her infant daughter to her chest. Are you nervous?
Yeah.
Nadine's nervous because what she's doing is illegal. By moving into this foreclosed house, she could be arrested for trespassing, breaking and entering, possibly even burglary. She's taking this risk because her husband was deported to the Bahamas in September, and her salary as a researcher at FIU wasn't enough to cover the mortgage. She lost her own home in North Miami to foreclosure.
It's really good to get families off the streets because they do take your kids away if they find you on the street, but the shelter won't pick you up if you are not on the street. So I don't understand how it's supposed to work. I really don't. It doesn't make any sense to me.
The home Nadine is moving into is owned by Aurora Loan Services, a subsidiary of Lehman Brothers. Aurora Loan Services declined to comment. Max gives Nadine a tour of the house. He opens a sliding glass door and we walk inside.
Okay. Come on.
Thank you.
The house is in good shape. White tiles in the kitchen and living room.
Top floors.
Recently painted walls.
But everything is structurally sound.
Good tile.
The utilities are still on.
Fully functional water.
Oh, great.
The electrical system is still intact. Okay, let's go.
We walk through the bedrooms, one by one.
So this is a 4-bedroom.
Oh, wow.
3 of the bedrooms are here.
Okay.
Much better than the shelter.
Finally, we get to the master suite.
Wow.
We stop at the walk-in closet.
Oh, wow. Okay, me and my daughter can hide in here. Oh, I'm going to sleep here, I think. Yeah.
Why would you and your daughter hide in there? Why would you have to hide?
Well, because we're alone. I mean, you know. Don't you think it's better to sleep in there?
What is it? Tell me.
I was thinking we could, me and her can just stay in that closet in there. We don't have that much furniture or anything.
Well, of course, we're going to provide you the furniture we can. We do have a bed for you.
Yeah, okay.
And the bed is going to be too big for in there. It's a queen-size bed.
Oh, okay.
And we don't want you to hide. We want you to live here openly.
Okay.
So we don't want you to sneak in the back if you come over here. So these are the keys.
Oh,
so you have the only set of keys.
Oh, thank you.
These are your keys. This is your
key. Oh, my goodness. I haven't had keys in months.
Max brought a locksmith to the house a few days earlier to change the locks. What does it feel like to get a key?
Oh, I'm a human being now. I'm an adult. You know, I'm emancipated. Now, you know, I can come in and go as I please. I don't have to go to the back door like some kind of, you know, Jim Crow era type thing.
Nadine has a master's degree in anthropology. She's working on a PhD in sociology. Do you find yourself a little mystified by where you are?
It's very suicidal indeed. I mean, I'm a child of immigrants. You go to college so you can uplift yourself. Since 2001, in Miami, it's just been hell. Nobody would hire me. I tried so many different places. It was just like, sorry. Wrong age, wrong ethnicity because I don't speak Spanish. It was one thing after another.
You know, I know this is a little bit of a sensitive question, but how long, realistically, do we think this family can stay here?
Well, based on past experience, it's probably going to be right around 6 months before someone finds that they're here. With that said, then there's the question of how long between that time and the time that they have to leave. So Take Back the Land, we feel like this is their home. This certainly, in my mind, this home belongs more to them than it does to Lehman Brothers or it does to some holding bank. And therefore, if they want to stand and fight to stay here, we're ready to stand and fight for their right to be here.
What does that mean?
That means if they come and they try to physically remove the family, we'll come and we'll physically try to defend them. We would defend the house.
Dan, has Take Back the Land ever had to physically defend a house for a family?
Well, not so far. All of the families that have been discovered have chosen to move rather than fight.
What does he mean when he says they would physically defend the house?
Basically, they would barricade themselves in and create like a human shield to physically stop the police from evicting him.
Wow.
One of the kind of weird things that came out of this is that so far people aren't complaining. In fact, neighbors are really happy to have these families in these homes because the alternative is so much worse. And the huge conundrum for Take Back the Land is that nobody's fighting back. Hmm. And so what was supposed to be this great act of political theater, this symbolic campaign to show that there are as many foreclosed homes as there are homeless people, has suddenly become a kind of social service. They recently got a call from a woman in southwest Miami-Dade actually requesting that they move some squatters into her neighbor's house. Apparently, it had been a marijuana grow house, and so the house was completely abandoned.
Hey, it's Peter in the control room.
Hey, Peter.
What I'm wondering is, I can't believe these guys were so willing to go on tape and tell their story. I mean, a lot of people would think this is bordering on anarchy. So I'm surprised that they're willing to, you know, publicize this that way.
When I first went out with them, we had agreed that I wouldn't use Nadine's name. I wouldn't say where the house was. Well, a few days after I did this piece, she was discovered by the realtor who is trying to resell the house. The locks were changed. All her stuff was thrown on the curb. And so they came back. They broke back in. They changed the locks again, and they moved her back in, got her new furniture and everything.
Take Back the Land changed
the locks? Take Back the Land. And the bank has not tried to get her out again. They know she's there.
One of the things that's so ironic here is that Nadine lost her home to foreclosure, and she's moving into a foreclosed home. Couldn't she have just stayed home?
Exactly. You know, the system is so messed up, right?
So obviously she can't live in there forever. What's going to happen after this?
This story actually has a bit of a happy ending. Nadine is right now working with a Miami-Dade County agency to place her in a more permanent home. They're talking about putting her in a two-bedroom apartment in southwest Miami-Dade. It's called supportive housing. And so she'll pay 30% of whatever her income is that month, and in exchange, she has to see a counselor.
It's Under the Sun on 91.3 WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch. Today we're talking about South Florida as the end of the line.
The actual end of the line in Florida is Key West, of course, and for about 23 years in the early 20th century, a railroad could get you there. It was Henry Flagler's dream. It was referred to as Flagler's Folly, actually, because it seemed like such a crazy idea. Today, those railroad tracks stop midway. They just kind of hang in the air above the ocean. We asked Mitchell Kaplan, owner of the bookstore Books and Books, to interview author Les Standiford, whose history of the railroad is called Last Train to Paradise.
I'm with Les Standiford here, and it's great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be here, Mitchell.
One of the ways that I build this book whenever I sell it is to tell people that it's, in essence, in telling the story of Henry Flagler and the train to Key West, you're telling the story of the development of the whole East Coast of Florida, more or less.
In the end, that's what it became. At first, I was just taken by the drama of the big storm that came in and wrecked this railroad. But, of course, to appreciate the drama of the end of something, you have to come to understand how it began. The proper place to begin, as you point out with this story, is with Flagler, who was the co-founder of Standard Oil, himself putting an end to that part of his career in his 50s and moving to Florida and becoming a hotelier and railroad man. He began the process of developing resorts, marching steadily down the east coast of Florida, built the Ponce de Leon Hotel in St. Augustine, now Flagler College, built that hotel there, realized that he would need to get a railroad built to get people to it, and continued that process on down to Palm Beach and to Miami at every stop along the way, saying, this is it. This is as far as I'm going. This is the end of the line. But the truth is, he couldn't stop. There was something in him that kept him from being able to stop.
I want to get to the nugget of that, because all of us who've been here for such a long time, you know, understand that South Florida, Florida is often a place where people come for a second act in their lives, more or less. And what was it in Flagler that fascinated him so much about this mosquito-infested swampland that we call our home now?
Well, he grew up in the Midwest, and one magazine writer, trying to get at the core of what made Flagler tick, kind of like the reporter that goes around in Citizen Kane trying to figure out why did Hearst say Rosebud on his deathbed. Anyway, in this case, a real reporter tried to get him to open up about these very things, and in his piece said, here's a kid who grew up in the flatlands of northwestern Ohio, came down to Florida and saw palm trees, and felt those ocean breezes, and he was seduced on the spot and never got over it, and just kept the further, every time he went a little bit further south, he saw something even more amazing.
Now, talk about the engineering feat that last stretch of railroad was.
Nothing of the engineering complexity had ever been done before, because this was a railroad built largely over open water. And if it wasn't on water, it was being built on remnants of coral reef, unstable land that was just two or three feet above sea level in most cases. Nothing like that had ever been done, certainly not for 153 miles. It would be like building the George Washington Bridge for 153 miles.
Remind us of the year again.
This was 1905 when it began. And this was a project that the press called, they thought Flagler was out of his mind. He was 75 years old when he started this project. Of course, when he finished, it was called the Eighth Wonder of the World 7 years later. But over that period of 7 years, there were colossal obstacles to overcome, not the least of which was just being so far from any kind of supportive infrastructure. Miami was a town of 1,000 people. He didn't have labor. He didn't have manufacturing centers that produced raw materials. Everything had to be brought in from hundreds and even thousands of miles away. Workers came from Spain. They came from the Cayman Islands, from the Bowery in New York City. One job was alligator wrangler. There was a man who was hired to every morning chase the alligators off the boats so the guys could get on the boats and go to work. I should say one thing about the completion of the railroad. Flagler was 82 at the time the railroad began to near Key West and was in failing health. And everybody who had worked for so long on this project, the camaraderie, esprit de corps, was a lot like it was among the NASA folks up at Cape Canaveral here a few years ago. This race to get this impossible thing done and this feeling of dedication to this man who had brooked no obstacles in making it get done. And paid the men well and fed them well and taken good care of them. The lead engineer at one point said, there isn't a man working on this project who wouldn't give a year of his own life to see Mr. Flagler ride his own iron to Key West before he dies. And in fact, they did rush to get it done so that he could ride it just shy of his 82nd birthday. And he did arrive in Key West where 10,000 people turned out to greet him, more than who lived in the entirety of the rest of Florida at the time.
So now let's talk about the storm that Hemingway helped out in, and it was legendary.
There had been reports of a storm that had passed through the Florida Straits, headed toward the Yucatan a couple of nights before Labor Day of 1935. But then a strange thing happened. A front came through, coming from the west, coming from the Pacific, and pushed that hurricane 180 degrees back, and then just went east of Key West and landed in Isla Morada, where these 700 vets were living in tents on this land that's about 4 feet above sea level. And the result was catastrophe. Most of these men swept out to sea and drowned. The death tolls any place between 500 and 1,000, depending on whose figures you use. And the accounts of the few survivors are chilling and amazing. And the engineer of the rescue train sent down to try to pull these guys out at the last minute before it was too late, just as some of the men were and wives and children were scrambling to board this train, a tidal wave of 20 feet swept over the island and washed everything except the engine away, all the people except the fireman and the engineer and the conductor who were in the cab of the locomotive. It was the most powerful storm, and still to this day, ever to strike American shores.
And as you tell it with a novelist's voice and eye, it's really one of the most compelling descriptions of a hurricane that I've ever read. I think you've identified a passage to read, and I'd love to have a discussion with you, capped off with a bit of a reading.
This talks about where we are now in Key West. Though now the pirates and the wreckers are gone, as are the turtle-raising corrals and the sponge divers and the cigar factories and the Cuban rollers and their lectors who read newspapers and novels aloud while those men worked, and the blustery big-game hunting author Hemingway who loved it all. Though all this has vanished, and though the shrimpers and the fishermen and the Navy boys are nearly gone as well, obdurate Key West remains. Irreverent and, to some, irrelevant, the oddball city at the end of the line is still the last resort. The sun still shines, the Gulf Stream still flows, and the palms still wave in the island's balmy breezes. Tourists and sports fishermen still descend. The colonies of writers and artists endure, and Hemingway's house on Whitehead has become a museum where the curious and the devoted come by the hundreds and the thousands each day.
Thanks, Les, for spending time here with me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Mitchell Kaplan speaking with Les Standiford, author of Last Train to Paradise, Henry Flagler and the Spectacular Rise and Fall of the Railroad That Crossed an Ocean. You can hear the complete interview on our website, WLRNunderthesun.org.
The bed of the well, the end of the line, the dismay in the face, it's a loss, it's a find, a spear, a spike, a point, a nail, a drip, a drop, the end of the tale.
You are listening to Under the Sun. We're telling the stories of South Florida. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch. If you follow Route 1 to the very end of the Florida Peninsula, veer onto Card Sound Road and make your way through a mangrove swamp, you'll find it. A wooden shanty. A roof, but no walls. It's the very last place on the U.S. mainland. And it's a restaurant and bar called Alabama Jack's.
How it's got its name is because the people who originally started was Jack and Alice Stratum. And they're from Alabama. They started a local fish camp down here back in the 40s called Alabama Jack's. My name is Mike Segay, and the way I got here is because in 1979, my mom, Phyllis, ended up buying this bar. She was a single mother with three kids, and at this point right now, my mom pretty much is retired, and me and my sister run it for her. You get the different people here. You get the bikers, you get the regulars, you get the ocean reapers, you get the tourists, you know.
My name is Selena. I'm actually the band manager. This is our 23rd year in August. Been here a long time. It's my brother is the guitar player, Jeffrey, and my husband's the drummer, Billy Bob. And Jimbo's our steel guitar player, and Artie's our bass player. And our Uncle Bill is on the keyboard. On Sunday, they have a good team of dancers that come in. They're older ladies, and they do clogging, buck dancing, that kind of thing.
I'm Betty Witten. Every Sunday we're here, just loving dancing.
How long have we been coming here? About 30-some years?
30-some years. Right to the same old spot.
There's no other reason to come out on Card Sound Road, really, except for to come out to Alabama Jack.
Well, we went fishing on the bridge with my grandson and my son and his girlfriend. And then on the way back, we stopped here. And once we stopped here, that was it. We were locked in. You get away from the concrete jungle of the city.
If we don't have the regulars here, we don't have anything. It's just another place on the side of the road. I mean, we'll pass up a celebrity to take care of one of our regulars, no doubt about it.
They call me the Doll. I was Mike's roommate up in college. I've met him and been friends ever since. You get lucky to meet people like that in your life, so. Been blessed.
Good drinking buddies.
Good drinking buddies.
I get people that have been coming here for 50 years and give me the history on it. They're like, you know what? You weren't even born, I've been here. So this place just makes it. You know, for some reason, God won't shut her down. I don't know. You know, just keeps me chugging along.
That piece was produced by Under the Sun's Robert Lyle. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
Should we go to a break?
Sure. Here's what's coming up. A very personal remembrance of the Orange Bowl.
Where privileged cats go to live out their remaining lives.
And South Florida's own bridge to nowhere.
It's Under the Sun. We'll be back in a minute. We're back with Under the Sun on 91.3 WLRN. We're telling the stories of South Florida. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman. Today we're bringing you stories about South Florida as the end of the line. A year ago, it was the end of the line for the Miami Orange Bowl. It had been around for more than 70 years. The University of Miami Hurricanes played at the football stadium. So did the Miami Dolphins. And it's where the third College Bowl game was played, after the Rose and Sugar Bowls. In the weeks before its demolition, the stadium was auctioned off piece by piece.
I have 175 and now two. 175 and a 200.
Yes!
200.
Seats, the scoreboard, even the coach's urinal. Retiree Lou Sanchez was there, but not for the fire sale.
My godfather is buried here in the Orange Bowl. His ashes are on the 50-yard line, the 30, and in the end zone. He was buried here in February of 1990. And after we laid the ashes, the University of Miami went on to win 58 home games here, and it set a national record.
Four and a half, are you through?
Do it, do it, do it!
Got to go right now. Sold online, $400.
If you've ever donated an old jacket or a dress or even a pair of socks to a thrift store, there's a chance it ended up in the Saatchi collection in London. That's because Miami-based duo Guerra de la Paz makes thrift store cast-offs into art. I went with them to their art supply store, as they call it, so they could show me where they start.
See, like, where am I going to find green pantyhose? Opaque green pantyhose. Gotta have it.
The sun is beating down on Alain Guerra and Neraldo de la Paz. Sweat drips into their eyes as they reach into dumpsters filled with discarded clothing. They yank hard, pulling out old sweaters, polyester disco shirts, a single army green rubber boot.
Whatever you find that you kind of can use, you just pull it.
The clothing comes to this warehouse from thrift shops all over the country. It's bound mostly for the Caribbean, but mountains of it, sometimes 15 feet high, get left behind in Miami. What are you holding? What did you pick up?
A pair of leopard stretch pants. We're making a tree out of leopard skin fabric right now. The trunk is all leopard. So what I'll do is I'll cut it into strips, and this will be a branch. This is our art supply store. It's been good to us.
I'm the only person they've ever brought here, and to get them to do it, I had to swear not to reveal where it is. They drove me here in their pickup truck and stopped just short of blindfolding me,